Back in 1995, Jenny and I left our employment with Ambassador University, as it was called at that time, and we moved north as God opened a door for us to go to Commerce and A&M University in Commerce. When I went there, I wasn't planning to work. I was planning to focus on my graduate degree. Jenny had secured a job that would take care of the two of us, and we were in campus housing, and I was going to focus in on my studies. Many of you know local member here, Jennifer Browder. She called us shortly after arriving and said the Dean of Education was looking for a graduate assistant. In fact, there were two positions that were open, so I might look into that. I thought, well, it might be a good thing to do, so I went. They realized that I had what they were looking for both positions, so they killed the other one and just hired me. As I worked for the dean, there were a number of duties that I had for the 4 or 5 years that I worked for him, and one of them was proofreading dissertations. So he didn't have the time to go through and proofread them, but the dean was supposed to weigh in on any dissertation that was to come through and have his signature when it was finished. So it fell my lot to do some of the proofreading for him. There are a number of those that I remember reading. One in particular inspired some thoughts on what I would like to speak to you about today. The dissertation was an educational psychology dissertation, and it was about a concept called locus of control. I found an intriguing idea then, and I've thought about it ever since, and have wanted to give a message on locus of control or the idea of control. Let me define for you, because locus of control may not mean much to you. Locus just simply means place. So where do you, as an individual, place control? And control is just simply the power to determine an outcome. So where do you place control? Now, the concept in a nutshell is as we live our life and experience the events of life, who is it that determines our direction?
Thank you.
Now I have two. I had somebody hand me a water bottle. I thank you. I'm going to probably use the cup and save the water bottle. So the concept in a nutshell of locus of control is as we experience the events in our life, who determines our direction? Who gets the credit or the blame for what happens to us? And as the theory goes, there's two possibilities. There's internal locus of control and external locus of control. An internal locus of control simply means that we base our success on our own work and believe we are in control of our lives. An external locus of control is where those who attribute their success or failure to outside influences. And they'll list certain things like luck, fate, or divine intervention. Now, the emphasis, as you might imagine, in a secular field, and certainly in our secular world, is an increasing interest on moving someone towards internal, meaning you control your life, as opposed to superstitions, as they would see them. You know, we can't have divine intervention clouding the picture and their perspective. Man determines his outcome, and they give credit to occasional luck or chance playing a good or a bad role in a person's life. Now, we often witness people giving credit for where they are at a particular point in life. Graduation speeches, you'll hear someone list off individuals who've made an impact in their life. Sometimes at a wedding, you'll hear a speech doing some of the same things. Oftentimes, if there's a competitive situation going into the competition or coming out the other end of the competition, someone will give credit many different directions. So I ask you today, as you sit here, who gets the credit for where you are today? It's kind of a tricky question to answer. You know, our culture, our church culture, frowns upon an I did it my way. Look what I accomplished. The self-made man approach. And for good reason. Some of you might give credit to family, friends, teachers, or mentors, a minister. Also, good reasons or good people to give credit to. Many of us have been positively influenced by any number of those. You also might give the right answer, and it may be from the heart, or it may just be the right answer, and that is you give God and Jesus Christ the credit. But who is it that you give the credit to for where you are today? Who determines the direction in your life? Who gets the credit for where you are today? And how should we address the issue of control in our lives? Now, let me make a few disclaimers before I go forward from here. I am not a psychologist. I don't claim to know the entire field of research that involves locus of control, nor is that my purpose to go through all of that with you today. I also don't have the dynamic of control fully figured out in my own life. So my hope today is to encourage some thought on the topic and to provide a few biblical examples that address the issue. So when we ask the question of who impacts or who do you give credit or who has control in your life today, let's just begin by identifying the players. You heard me mention some of them as we went through the introduction. First one would be self. You are certainly a factor when it comes to control in your life. We won't turn there, but many of you know the blessings and cursings chapter in Deuteronomy 28. You do what's right, and there's a positive outcome. You do what's wrong, there's a negative outcome. And as you read through that passage, the emphasis is on you and your decision. We make decisions that determine the course of our life. And you've heard of the term free will. You heard Mr. Armstrong years ago talk about free moral agency. So we do have a measure of control in our lives. Second player would be just simply be under the category of others. Could be, as we listed before, parents, friends, ministers, teachers, mentors. They've helped us to overcome. They've encouraged us, supported us, and many more things. Third would be God and Jesus Christ, the ultimate authority and the ultimate in control. But you know, if we stop at that list right there, there are many who believe that we stop right there. And this position causes a bit of difficulty when we address evil in the world. Why doesn't God do something about it is usually the position that's taken. If you read one of the more recent Life, Hope, and Truth insight into news and prophecy, one of the more recent ones by Tim Groves addresses this. It requires an understanding of the fourth player in the mix, and that's Satan. He influences, but he has limits. God has put limits on him. It's not, as a famous comedian said many years ago, the devil made me do it. He doesn't make you do it. As we've referenced often, Ephesians 2:2 talks about him being the prince of the power of the air. And as that same article, that insight article in the email that we received, pointed out, he affects our attitudes, our moods, and our ideas. So these are the players, these four: self, others, God and Christ, and Satan. These are the players. But as you consider the players and we consider the issue of control, there's a difference between influence and the power to determine an outcome, which we call control. And I'm using the term control in the context in this audience of what we understand as the ultimate outcome, and that is eternal life. So parents, friends, we refer to peer pressure, all of these things influence us. But when it's all said and done, we stand alone before God an answer for our direction. Satan influences all of mankind, but we answer for our sins. So if we take out the two that are more in the role of influencers, it leaves us with two. That leaves us with God and ourselves. This really plays back into what I was referring to with internal and external locus of control. External locus of control can refer to divine intervention. Internal refers to the fact that we control our direction. So the theory, in part, has that correct. Those in that field are very concerned with human behavior. When they look at locus of control and they're looking at how people go through life, they want people to have a healthy view. So if you take any event in your life and analyze it, you know, there have been good outcomes and there have been bad outcomes in life. As internal and external locus of control factor in, a good outcome, you can credit yourself. I did it. I made this happen. Or credit God. That also, in that world, at least opens up the aspect of superstition here also. I'll cover that in just a second. If there's a bad outcome, we can blame ourselves. That's internal locus of control. Or we can blame God. So when you look at history, I'll give you a couple examples. When you look at history, take ancient up to the present. It's still happening today. There are people around this globe who do strange and bizarre things to appease an idol to get what they want. I think we would all agree that that's not healthy. These psychologists would also agree that they're stuck in superstition. When a person's always blaming themselves for everything that happens or every bad thing that comes along and then can't figure out how something that went right happened, how did that luck happen, that also is not a healthy place to be. So you can see some examples of individuals that they would want to counsel to be a little more balanced in their perspective. Now I want to step away from the world of psychology and locus of control, since I'm talking to an audience that's certainly more interested in the spiritual aspect of things. So we'll take a turn here, and I want to ask you now, what is a healthy view of control, spiritually speaking? What's a healthy view of control, spiritually speaking? Now, where I'm going to start to address this may at first appear to be a little bit of a detour. But I'm going to tell you where I'm going first, and then you'll hopefully see, after I've covered a little bit of ground, the point that I'll mention right now. A healthy view of control requires a clear understanding of place. You probably heard this in terms of know your place, a sense of place. Really, it's talking about, do you know your role? So where do you fit? What is your place? And what does that have to do with control? Turn with me to 2 Samuel 6. We're going to take a look at the example of Uzzah. Many of you know the story of Uzzah. As you're turning to 2 Samuel 6, I'll give you a little background. Prior to this break-in point in 2 Samuel 6. During the reign of King Saul, the Ark of the Covenant was captured by the Philistines, and they had it in their possession for 7 months. After repeated torment, they return it to Israel, and now it resides in the house of Abinadab, son of Saul. I always chuckle when I look back at that story. If you've never read the story of what happened to the Philistines when they tried to move that Ark around, it's somewhat humorous, painful if you are a Philistine, humorous if you understand the gravity of what they had in their possession. So the ark rests in the house of Abinadab, son of Saul, for 13 years. Saul and Abinadab both die, and David now takes the throne, and his desire is to move the ark from the house of Abinadab to Jerusalem where he's established his residence. So we'll start in 2 Samuel 6 and verse 1. And David got together all the fighting men of Israel to the number of 30,000. And David and all the people who were with him went to Baal of Judah to get the Ark of God, over which the holy name is named, the name of the Lord of armies, whose place is between the winged ones. And they put the Ark of God on a new cart and took it out of the house of Abinadab, which is on the hill. And Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were the drivers of the cart. And Uzzah went by the side of the ark, while Ahio went before it. And David and all the men of Israel made melody before the Lord with all their power and with songs and with corded instruments and instruments of brass. And when they came to Nacon's grain floor, Uzzah put his hand on the ark of God to keep it safe in its place, for the oxen were out of control. And the wrath of the Lord burning against Uzzah sent destruction on him because he had put his hand on the ark, and death came to him there by the ark of God. And David was angry because of the Lord's outburst of wrath against Uzzah, and he gave that place the name Perez Uzzah, which is its name to this day. And such was David's fear of the Lord that day that he said, "How may I let the ark of God come to me?" So David did not let the ark of God come back to him to the town of David, but had it turned away and put in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. Now, you've probably heard messages about Uzzah before. There were a number of errors that took place in the transportation of the ark. First of all, Uzzah, who was a Levite, was not one of the sons of Kohath. If you need a reference point, that's Numbers 4, verse 14. Numbers 4, verse 14 mentions that the sons of Kohath were the ones, or the branch of the Levites, who were the only ones permitted to transport the ark. The second error that was made is the ark was transported on a cart. This was the method that the Philistines had used to move it around. It was not carried by men using poles, as again was prescribed in Numbers 4, verse 14. And the third error, also mentioned in Numbers 4, verse 14, was that the ark was never to be touched. Uzzah took on himself the safety of the ark, touched it, and lost his life for doing so. Now, we know he's the central character, but when you look past Uzzah, this is really a story and a lesson for David. David's the king. David's the one who's in charge in this circumstance, and David is the one who wants it moved from where it was to his new location. He's the one in control, we could say, of the situation. When Uzzah died, notice back in verse 8, it says David was very angry. Now you can imagine all the thoughts that would run through your head if you were the one in charge of this situation. And all of this was supposed to go well. Wasn't everything under control? Weren't we moving it as it had been moved many times before? Isn't this a good thing to move the ark from where it was to its new location? Why would this happen? Why would someone die because of good intents to move this from one place to another? David was angry with God. We can see a little bit of the external locus of control. You're to blame for this person's death. There had to be a little time that transpired before verse 8 and verse 9. If you'll notice verse 9, it now says David was afraid. He's puzzled. How do I proceed now? I don't know what I should do. Someone has died. Am I going to die too? Am I supposed to even move the ark? Is it God's will that it stays put? Will someone else die other than me from moving this? How should it be moved? What should be done differently? What should I learn from this experience? So you'll notice in verse 11, it's moved aside for 3 months and resides with the house of Obed-Edom before David goes back and retrieves it. Over in 1 Chronicles 15, we pick up the story where he returns. And in 1 Chronicles 15 and verse 1, the account is going through David's preparations. Very different from the preparations that took place in 2 Samuel. 1 Chronicles 15, verse 1. And David made houses for himself in the town of David. He got ready a place for the ark of God and put up a tent for it. Then David said, "The ark of God may not be moved by any but the Levites." And we'll see in just a minute, he's not just meaning the Levites. He's mentioning that specific branch. "For they have been marked out by God to take the ark of God and to do his work forever." Verse 3, "And David made all Israel come together at Jerusalem to take the ark of the Lord to its place, which he had got ready for it. And David got together the sons of Aaron and the Levites and the sons of Kohath." These are the guys that were supposed to carry it. "Uriel the chief and his brothers and 120. And said to them, 'You are the heads of the families of the Levites. Make yourself holy, you and your brothers, so that you may take the ark of the Lord, the God of Israel, to the place which I have made ready for it.'" And this is an important point in verse 13. "For because you, sons of Kohath, did not take it at the first, the Lord our God sent punishment on us because we did not get directions from him in the right way." Because we did not get directions from him in the right way. This is a real life account of control and knowing one's place. When we read in 1 Samuel 6, the account of control, it was without a sense of place. And it resulted in death, anger, and dismay. When we move ahead now to 1 Chronicles 15, it's an account of control with a sense of place. David now does it, as we read in verse 13, the right way. We know, it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway in context of what we're talking about. We know that God is in control. When we submit our control to him on his terms, the outcome's a good one, as we see in 1 Chronicles. When we exercise our control on our terms, it doesn't turn out well. And we just see one example in the life of Uzzah and the death of Uzzah and King David. You know, like King David and Uzzah, each of us have free will. We have the ability to determine what we'll do. And we use that control in the context of knowing our place. And it's crucial to success. I want you to consider the importance through history of knowing one's place in combination of control. Getting that dry spot. You will see, hopefully, after I go through a number of these, that the combination of control and knowing one's place has been at the core of all of known history. Let's start first with Satan's rebellion. This was definitely an issue of control and knowing one's place. You can turn there if you wish. Very famous passage that we've read often when it comes to describing Satan. It's Isaiah 14. Isaiah 14 and verse 13 and 14. Satan says in his heart, "I will go up to heaven. I will make my seat higher than the stars of God." And in verse 14 says, "I will go higher than the clouds, and I will be like the Most High." Satan did not keep his place. He did not honor his role that was God-given. We see as we step into human existence, Adam and Eve fall for the same thing. Genesis 3:5, Satan lays that same bait out there that he was the father of, and he states to Eve, God knows that in the day that you eat, then your eyes are going to be opened, and you will be as gods, knowing good and evil. They made a bad choice, and we know the results of that bad choice. If we just mention names in the context of control and knowing your place, their children follow the same suit, Cain and Abel. We look at the events at the Tower of Babel, issue of control and knowing your place. The flood. We see positive examples like those of Job, but he too had to be reminded of his place. Abraham and Lot. The children of Israel constantly struggling to know their place and who was in control. Saul lost his crown over this issue. David had more than one occasion where he ran into this problem. Solomon too forfeited his crown. When Israel and Judah go into captivity, this too is an issue of who is in control and did you or did you not make the right decision. While some of the children of Israel and Judah are in captivity, we have a lesson made to the ruler who's taken them captive. And you know the story of Nebuchadnezzar and where he has to come to grips with who put him there. Who's really in control? Who put him in his office? Who took him out of his office and made him like a wild animal and then brought him back? When we move into the New Testament, we have individuals like the Sons of Thunder who want to rain down terror on people who have done the wrong thing. Peter is a fun study in knowing his place. He was constantly stepping out and being told to step back. Paul makes a tremendous transformation from his initial role to the role he became in the proper context and place. If we zoom to the end and this fall festival season that we've just celebrated, isn't this also a matter of control and knowing place? We look at the Feast of Trumpets. It's the time when God and Christ in particular, will make known to this world who is really in control. Day of Atonement pictures the removal of all barriers to that, and Satan's influence will be removed. Feast of Tabernacles, we see the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, that is ultimate control, will take his place, and you either fall in line or there's problems. And the last great day, all opposition will be removed in the end, and Christ will, when it's all said and done and this earth is cleansed, will hand over control to God the Father. So for all that we know through human history, from the first rebellion that occurred to as far out as we know, when God will take control of this earth, and those who will be around are those who've committed themselves to him. It's been an issue of control. And it's been an issue for every player below God to know their place. Is this not central to God's entire plan? What better ground for Satan to confuse and beat up than our sense of place? You know, if you consider this world, and I know you're familiar with all the headlines, you work with people at work, I'm immersed in it in a high school setting where I see the results of terrible family situations, drug abuse, psychological issues from schizophrenic parents and what that does to children, families that break apart, and there's two and three generations of stepchildren. All of these things come into my classroom. And the results of those. This world has done their level best with Satan's driving the bus. to remove God from the scene. Evolution, championed as the way to look at things. And when you take God out of the scene and you put evolution in place, it leaves us to determine what goes on in the future. And we do crazy things like GMOs and all this other stuff that we play with, not knowing what that's going to do to us as a people 10 and 20 years down the road. We've been doing that, and our record is terrible. We play with chemicals, thinking that they will solve a problem, only to find out they destroy our health and everything around us. When everything's left to man to figure out, then all of a sudden we look at the traditions, and that's where they're relegated. They're not relegated to something God established. They're just relegated as antiquated traditions. What's the point of the family? What's the point of religion? What's the point of character? If it's survival of the fittest, get out there, get gritty, go after it, step on whoever you need to step on to get ahead. And even worse, for those of us in this country, and you don't really realize it unless you travel outside of this country often, but as Americans, we're very good at using our perceived freedom, our rights, our independent spirit to give us the right to do whatever we want to do. Our world today is one that is void of a sense of place. But you know, as God's people, our dog is not in this fight. This is not where we're supposed to be. We have directions that transcend all of the baloney going on around us. Directions that identify who is really in control, proper exercise of free will, and God-appointed roles with a well-defined sense of place. So what I'd like to do with the rest of the time is take you through some of these biblically God-defined roles and where control resides with God. He gives it in certain places. So let's take a look at a few of these. First of all, God has given authority to human governments, whether we like it or not. We're subject to them. There's a well-defined sense of place and who has control in this circumstance. Like I referenced with Nebuchadnezzar, God's the one who allows or places those in governing positions. We have the human governments who've been appointed, and then we're in third after that. If you look at 1 Peter 2, keep in mind as we read 1 Peter 2 that the authorities that are being referred to as contemporary with Peter are despicable people. You've heard me speak about Nero and Caligula, and if you don't remember that, you've probably done enough study on those two to know what despicable people they were. Yet these were the people in charge at the time, and those that they appointed in many cases weren't any better. 1 Peter 2 and verse 13. Then be in obedience to every ordinance of man. In one translation, it just simply says, submit to every human authority. Why? And here's the issue of control in play again. Because of the Lord. As Nebuchadnezzar learned, he's the one who allows for them or puts them there. Whether as king, as supreme, or to governors, these are the appointed officers that the king sends. They're sent by him for vengeance on evildoers, but for praise on well-doers. Let me read to you that first verse that we read, verse 13, in another translation. This is God's words translation. Place yourself under the authority of human governments to please the Lord. Obey the emperor. He holds the highest position of authority. Let's jump down to verse 15 now. For such is the will of God Sometimes we ask, we're not sure what he wants for us to do. It's hard to dodge this one. For such is the will of God, doing good to silence the ignorance of foolish men. And this is the one where sometimes our American sense of freedom can get in the way. So he tells us in verse 16, as free and not having freedom as a cover of evil, but as servants of God. You know, we may live in a country that allows for freedom, but where does the use of that freedom cross over and begin to transgress the law and the will of God? That's the question we should ask ourselves. And then finally in verse 17, honor all, love the brotherhood, fear God, and honor the king. So God has given authority to human governments, and our job, as we've read in 1 Peter, is to be subject to them and to do so because of God and to do so for God's purpose. Second one, God gives authority to the ordained elders of the church. This too is a well-defined sense of place and who has control. God is in control. He's given his church, or the church, to Jesus Christ. Elders are to do the work of Christ. And then we as the church members are to be subject to the elders. 1 Peter 5. 1 Peter 5, we'll start in verse 1. First Peter 5 and verse 1. I exhort the elders. Now, in this particular passage, I'll reference Gill's commentary. He's making the point here. These are men of office whose business it is to feed the flock. So these are not elders. It's not referring to the older. In this case, it is referring to pastors, the ministers, who are among you. I, being also an elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. Verse 2, feed the flock of God among you, taking the oversight, not by compulsion, but willingly, nor for base gain, but readily. Nor is lording it over those allotted to you by God, but becoming examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd shall appear, you shall receive a never-fading crown of glory. Now, you'll notice in that passage that I read, it's pointing out that they're responsible, and they were given that responsibility by God. But it also lists in verses 2 and 3 their responsibilities. So it's important as we go through these next ones to remember that while someone may be appointed responsibility or authority over another entity, God expects both parties to behave according to his instructions. So it's not a one-sided thing. That's not implying that we've witnessed that, except for extreme circumstances many years ago. Third point, whether you're younger or you're older, God tells us our place and where to exercise control. I'll read you two passages, one from 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy 5. This passage will also use the term elder, and I'll use Gill's commentary as a reference again. And he's making the point in this passage that this is not referring to an elder in office, but in age. So in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 1, it says, do not sharply rebuke an elder or an older member, but exhort as a father and the younger ones as brothers, older women as mothers and younger as sisters in all purity. Honor widows who are widows indeed. So we're given some instructions to be respectful in all directions here to both the older and the younger. Also reference Titus. Titus in chapter 2. I'm going to read this in the Contemporary English Version because one of the versions talked about the old men and the old women, and I'm sure many of you would dismiss that you apply. I'm not the old man. I'm not the old woman. As Mr. Jones said, the chronologically gifted. So in Titus 2 and verse 1, Titus is getting some instruction here, and it says, Titus, you must teach only what is correct. Verse 2, tell the older men to have self-control and to be serious and sensible. Their faith, love, and patience must never fail. Tell the older women to behave as those who love the Lord, as those who love the Lord should. They must not gossip about others or be slaves of wine. They must teach what is proper, so the younger women will be loving wives and mothers. Each of the younger women must be sensible and kind, as well as good homemakers, who put their husband first. Then no one can say insulting things about God's message. Tell the young men to have self-control in everything. Always set a good example for others. Be sincere and serious when you teach. Use clean language that no one can criticize. Do this, and your enemies will be too ashamed to say anything against you. That's the Contemporary English Version. So we see here roles that each of us are given, whether we're older or younger, whether we're the younger speaking to the older or vice versa. God gives us directions in our place and what things we have responsibilities for and where we would step outside of those God-given responsibilities. Fourthly, God established the family. He defines authority within the family and that structure and defined the roles for each participant. We'll look at this one in Ephesians 5. Ephesians 5, and we'll start in verse 22. And again, as we read through this, I want you to notice that all parties in this have responsibilities to one another. I know oftentimes, and Mr. Burnett alluded to this when he spoke about the roles of men and women and a message he gave a while back, it's not a one-sided thing where one takes a club and beats it over the other. You know, as a husband or as a parent or as a teacher, I can abuse my authority. If I do so, I'm responsible to God for my use of that authority because He's the one who's given the responsibility to me. So in verse 22 of Ephesians 5, wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present to himself as the glorious church without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but it should be as holy and without blemish. So men ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no man yet hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, even as the Lord loves the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall be joined to his wife, and the two of them shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. But also let every one of you in particular so love his wife as himself, and the wife that she defers to her husband. So there are roles that are God-defined. Neither of us gets off the hook if either of us abuse the responsibility that we're given. We answer to him. And it goes on to the rest of the family members in chapter 6 and verse 1. Children, obey your parents. And again, he's making the point here. In the Lord, that term, it's God's will, in the Lord, for the Lord's sake, keeps showing up in these passages. And again, it's establishing who has the control to give the authority, who has the control to set the bar where it's set. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, so that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. And then it turns it back. Fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. There's a constant back and forth. And as you go through life, you realize that even if you wear a hat of responsibility, you will have three or four other circumstances where you answer to somebody. That hat gets traded around sometimes. That responsibility is taken from you and given to someone else for good reasons, just in the transition of leadership. But we all have a responsibility no matter what level we're at. We've got someone that we are responsible to, and we are also making a choice. This is one thing, you know, when I read here about children obey your parents, when I talk to my kids, I don't want it just to be, I'm telling you to do this and you should do it because I'm your dad. I remind them often that their responsibility is to God. And even if I were out of the picture, they should be doing the right thing, whether I'm watching them or not. And as it said in verse 6, this is the one with promise. If you want something good for your life, if you want things to go well with you, please the one in control. I'm just the middleman. I was given the responsibility to take care of you and to work with you and hopefully raise you to where you will also respect that one who's in control. Lastly, God gives directions to, in Scripture, masters and slaves. I will say on my behalf, you can choose to do this or not to. I always put those terms in as employer, employee. We don't have a slave-master arrangement in our current society. You could argue the fact that we're slaves to our jobs. But in Ephesians 6, we'll start in verse 5. Whenever I read the word slave, just think of yourself as the employee. Masters, for some of you who are the employer or the boss, you can substitute that in as we read. So Ephesians 6 and verse 5. Slaves, obey your masters according to the flesh with fear and trembling and singleness of heart. And here's one of those phrases again. As to Christ. Not with eye service, not as men pleasers, but as the servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart. With goodwill doing service, and here's another one, as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good thing he does, he shall receive the same from the Lord, because he's the one in control, whether he is slave or a free man. And then masters, employers, the boss, do the same things to them, forbearing, threatening. Don't threaten them. Knowing that your master also is in heaven, and there is no respect of persons with him. You don't have an excuse just because you're given the authority at a particular moment. So we begin all of this by asking, what is a healthy view of control? And we ask that in terms of a spiritual context. You know, for God's people, as we sit here, we know absolutely God is in control. We also know that we've been given free will. We've been given the control of ourselves. We've been given the free will to choose between God's way and our way. And when we choose our way, all we're doing is following in Satan's footsteps. We're playing into his hand. As we went through all of known recorded history, has control at its core. And the Bible records many examples of failure and success for us to learn from. You know, the irony in all of this, many people want to take control so they can get what they want, so they can be happy, so they can have the best. If you want the best, if you want things to go well, if you want it to all turn out right, choose God.